Welcome to New York Institute of Technology's podcast, The Scope. Produced by the College of Osteopathic Medicine, our episodes focus on the medical school experience and how it helps shape future physicians. Learn about exciting new health and wellness initiatives, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and how to effectively navigate medical school. We are excited to have you join us.
Good afternoon, and welcome to a very special Dean's Circle edition of the Scope podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Wadsworth, Dean of the New York Institute of Technology, College of Osteopathic Medicine. It is my sincere honor and privilege to be on location at the Federation of State Medical Boards office in Washington, D.C., with a very special friend of NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine. Please welcome esteemed NYITCOM alumnus and advisory board member, former United States Air Force Reserves major and flight surgeon, and current president and chief executive officer of the Federation of State Medical Boards, Dr. Humayun Hank Chowdhury. Thank you, Dr. Chowdhury, for meeting with me today. We are so grateful to have this special opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Nicole. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Today, our conversation with Dr. Chowdhury will include highlights and insights gained throughout his wide-ranging professional roles. We will also explore his vision of medicine today and moving forward during these unparalleled times of rapid technological advancement and change. Before we delve into our conversation, I would like to provide our listeners with a few highlights from your remarkable medical career. Dr. Chowdhury grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and is a graduate of New York University, New York Institute of Technology, College of Osteopathic Medicine, class of 1991, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He completed a rotating osteopathic internship at St. Barnabas Hospital, followed by an ACGME accredited residency in internal medicine at NYU Langone Long Island Hospital, New York, where he spent an additional year as chief resident. Dr. Chowdhury served 13 years in the United States Air Force Reserves, where he rose to the rank of major and served as a flight surgeon. He also held the position of health commissioner for New York Suffolk County during the H1N1 pandemic. He is currently president and CEO of the Federation of State Medical Boards, FSMB, which represents the nation's state and territorial medical licensing boards and co-sponsors the United States Medical Licensing Examination. In addition to his current position at FSMB, Dr. Chowdhury is a clinical associate professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, past president of the American College of Osteopathic Internists, and master of the American College of Physicians, and a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians of both London and Edinburgh. From 2016 to 2018, Dr. Chowdhury was chair of the International Association of Medical Regulatory Authorities. He is the author or co-author of more than 80 peer-reviewed articles and two books. In 2022 and again in 2023, he was listed by Modern Healthcare as one of the 100 most influential people in healthcare. Wow. I have to say, your career accomplishments to date are truly amazing. And you're not done yet.
I'm not. Thank you, Nicole. I need to shorten that bio, probably.
With so much to talk about today, I'd like to dive right in.
Sure.
So I'll start sort of at the beginning. When did you first become interested in medicine?
So, you know, I was asking my mom that question the other day, and I think it has to do with growing up in Brooklyn. I had, for whatever reason, a lot of ailments as a young child, flus, coughs, GI issues. And so I used to go to our neighborhood pediatrician. I'll never forget, Alan Levin was his name. And I remember looking up at the certificate, the medical degree that he had from the University of Cincinnati, and thinking, wow, that must be a great medical school, because no matter what problem I had, he always knew how to calm me and my mother down and sort of always had the answer. And I was impressed by that. So I think that was an early sort of impression of what medicine can offer, compassion and also expertise. And I said, that sounds like something I should pursue.
That's great. You reminded me of my pediatrician's experience, and all I can remember is every time we would go, I would tell my mom, I don't want a shot. That's what I remember. So was there anything in addition that really influenced your career choice?
Well, you know, my father was an attorney and my mother was an educator, a teacher. So I knew I would do something at the professional level. My backup was law school, actually. and actually, it's a long story, but I actually did get into medical school and law school because I wanted to have a backup. So I took the MCAT, took the LSAT, and I was, I guess, in a unique position of having to choose between medicine and law, and I think I made the right choice.
That's great. So you've sort of certainly traveled the circle, if you will, at New York Tech. Since your days of attending medical school at NICOM and graduating in 1991, how does it feel to have transitioned through the roles of medical student, medical educator, and academic dean, and now executive leadership member of the NYITCOM advisory board?
It's a great question. And I think the key word there, Nicole, is transition, right? Because we all make transitions. And I remember at one point thinking, I'm a pretty good student. Could I be a graduate, someone with a medical degree after my name? And then I was a pretty good intern and resident. And I was like, I could keep going doing this, but could I be an attending where I make all the decisions? So I think life in medicine in particular is about these sorts of transitions. And each time you make a transition, you may remember they create some anxiety, but you grow and you learn and then you move on. And sometimes looking back, it's amazing. How did I get here? But sometimes you follow your instincts, you turn to advice from mentors and people who can guide you. And then, you know, I've been fortunate. It's worked out for me and it's worked out for most people, I would say.
That's great advice. So sort of follow your path,
yeah.
but use those around you to help perhaps cement the sides a little bit.
Definitely. And I've always included my family in, because, you know, whenever it was about, do I take this job or not, always made a pro and con list and made sure my family was involved in that decision making, because it wasn't just going to be my decision. It was going to impact my children and my wife as well.
Absolutely critical, I think, to be mindful of that.
Yeah.
Do you feel your past experiences as a medical student at NYITCOM provides you any special insights as you engage in your role in the advisory board?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things that you have been a very big supporter of, Nicole, and I appreciate you for that, is making sure that there's a balance between the work and the life that the students and the faculty and the staff enjoy. To be honest, that wasn't always considered a focus back when I was a student, but that was true in every medical school campus across the country and probably the world. So just to give you an idea, I remember vividly our class asking our class president, at what we used to call NICOM back then, see if you can get the dean to approve having a ping pong table in our recreation area where we used to, you know, eat for, have our cafeteria food and so forth. And that took months, but the decision was no, because they said, you know, this is a medical school campus. You're here to learn. You're not here to have fun. You're not here to have, you know, enjoyment. And I think back to what we do now, like with the healing path, and, you know, I think we're all in a better place. And I think having that experience as a student and what that meant today really helps me inform what I think is needed for the physician of tomorrow, the osteopathic physician of tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's tough. I think that's a vision we're all shooting for. But thanks to your advice and experience and the advisory board, I think we're much better.
Well, I think you're being humble, because I think the campus and the school, NYITCOM, is really a champion in this and could be a role model for other medical schools, both MD and DO around the country.
So, in preparing for the interview, one question that came to me. Was, you know, as you look back at your medical school days and while you were preparing for your boards, did you ever imagine to become CEO and president of the FSMB?
Never in a million years, furthest from my mind, because like most students, I wanted to be a good doctor who took care of patients. I had visions of working in a small town and sort of being the doctor that everyone knew. But I think my advice to medical students has always been, keep an open mind. You never know what kind of opportunities will come your way. And sometimes those opportunities involve taking a risk. The FSMB position, when I first took it back in 2009, required me to move to Texas. That's a big change from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a discussion with my family. can we do this? Are we going to do this? And so it was a risk I took, and I'm very grateful that I did, because throughout my life, while I've enjoyed taking care of patients at the bedside, one-on-one, as I think most doctors do, at some point, you wonder if you can do something different. And sometimes it's not one-on-one, it's through population health. So in my case, it was public health, but it was also when I went back to the campus and became an assistant dean and department chair, and that's sort of making sure that medical students are getting the right training. I did that when I was a DME at Long Beach Hospital on Long Island, and making sure the interns and residents were getting the education and training they need. And now with the FSMB, I do it on a much larger scale, making sure the nation's physicians are getting the education, skills, and training they need to be physicians for tomorrow.
So staying along your current role, can you share with us a little bit about what a day in the life is like?
Sure, sure. You sound like my mother. What is it exactly what do you do again? Because you're not practicing medicine. I'm not. And I do miss that because, especially as an osteopathic physician, I felt I was pretty good with my hand skills in OMT, but I don't get to use that as much other than with family and friends on occasion. But my role is as CEO of the FSMB, I've been doing it now for 15 years, is to represent the nation's state licensing boards. I think a lot of members of the public don't always know what a state medical board does, but it actually looks out for the public by making sure that only qualified individuals are practicing medicine, number one. And if there's an issue or a problem, taking the necessary steps to investigate. The FSMB doesn't do that, but our state licensing boards do, both our state medical and our state osteopathic boards. We have about 13 states that have separate licensing boards for osteopathic physicians. In all the other states, they're combined. And so part of my role on a typical day-to-day basis is to participate in various committees and work groups, usually virtually, but sometimes in person, on a whole bunch of issues. Currently, we're looking at resident training licenses. Some states, not New York, require training licenses for residents. Is that wise? We're having that discussion now, and I'm going to be making some recommendations to our state boards. Another is physician reentry, where a lot of physicians, especially during the pandemic, retired early or gave up practice. And now some of them are thinking of coming back now that the pandemic is over. You just give them a license back right away. How many years were they out? Do they need to demonstrate that they still know what they're doing? That's another issue that we're looking at. So, and then artificial intelligence, our ethics committee is looking at some guardrails. So those kinds of activities keep me busy. We're a part of this global world of medical regulation. The same issues we have, many countries have as well, because they want to make sure that people are protected and taken care of by safe, qualified doctors.
How do you feel that the healthcare industry as a whole is addressing issues that we're currently dealing with, including the drug overdose, the opiate crisis, as well as healthcare workforce needs?
Yeah, I mean, we can spend a couple hours talking about each of those, but you've hit on, Nicole, two of the issues that we're focused on right now. In fact, back in 2018, so that's like 6 years ago now, we partnered, the FSMB partnered with the National Academy of Medicine, which is also based in DC here, and became part of this action collaborative. Up to that point, the National Academy had been issuing reports on various issues, maybe some recommendations, but they did something different and unique by creating this action collaborative, an idea of bringing together interested organizations, stakeholders, to make a difference, to do something different. The only other action collaborative they had was also on clinician wellness, which is also another important area where it was felt that just having a document that sits on somebody's shelf is not doing anyone any favors. We need to actually do something. So we have been a part of that at the FSMB. From that, we created an opioid regulatory collaborative, working with our nursing, pharmacy, and dentistry colleagues, because the opioid issue and the overdose problem is really a universal issue for the health professions. And it's evolved, as you know. It used to be, the inappropriate prescribing of long-acting and extended-release opioids. That still is an issue from time to time, but now it's become more so a concern with synthetic opioids and alterated medications. And I think the other underlying problem is addiction. Mm-hmm. We have a big problem with addiction across the country, And during the pandemic, things have just gotten worse, more than 100,000 deaths all across the country on Long Island. Mm. So we're trying to come up with ways in which we can educate doctors and licensees, working in collaboration to educate the public about the harms of some of these substances that are out there, and looking at harm reduction, working with the Assistant Secretary of Health and others here in DC to try to figure this out.
So we touched on this a little bit, so I want to expand a little bit on the health and wellness for physicians.
Yes.
And I know you're an advocate, I'm certainly an advocate for that area. Mm-hmm. So what do you see as your role, as far as FSMB, as well as just an advocate to continue to improve physician wellness and well-being?
Well, two things. I think back to when I was a student, and that wasn't always a focus. So I think we need to, all educators like yourself, not just you, but also your faculty, I think need to be attuned to some of the realities of what medical students, residents, and fellows face. The suicide rate among physicians is far too high compared to the general population, and we need to enable a means by which people who need help can get help, number one. And I think your school is doing a wonderful job through its Center for Behavioral Health, as you know. But the other piece of that is, as it relates to licensure, is making sure that there is a comfort level for doctors like you and I, that if we are facing anxiety, depression, what have you, that it's okay to seek help. You know, we're patients too, we're not just doctors. And we're trying to get that message across, because there's this notion out there that, well, I'm a doctor, if I go see a doctor for my needs, whether behavioral or physical, what if that impacts my license? What if I can't practice medicine? And so we need to dispel that. We think it's perfectly okay for doctors to get care for themselves, especially if it's a behavioral issue. And I think there's this myth out there that licenses will be taken away if you're not able to practice medicine fully. And so many states have physician health programs that can offer one means by which you can keep your license, but get the help that you need. We're also working with many states who have changed their licensing applications to not ask questions about, have you ever been to a psychiatrist, for example, to something that's more of, what are your current situations and how are you managing that? My favorite is North Carolina, that has, instead of even a question on its licensure application, has sort of an attestation that you, as somebody who is applying for a license in the state of North Carolina, recognize that you also have an obligation to take care of yourself. Mm. Do you agree? And I think that kind of permission is what we all need to give students, residents, and our colleagues, because we can't have our workforce be impacted by that.
It's such a culture change, really.
It's a significant
culture change that, as you mentioned, when you were a medical student, it's like, just, hang in there, work hard, you'll be fine, as opposed to this more holistic approach to well-being is sort of how I think about it. And so our Center for Behavioral Health has been key in shifting that mindset and that culture that you need to take care of yourself, whether it's because you need a physical exam or you need some guidance in your depression. So I'm going to change gears a little bit, okay. And I'd like to take this opportunity to personally thank you for your 13 years service to our country in the United States Air Force Reserves. Your dedication and commitment are greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Having experienced firsthand the enormity of the dangers, challenges, and stressors associated with military deployment and combat, can you offer some advice to our listeners on how to effectively retain your internal peace and sound decision-making abilities during catastrophic challenges and circumstances?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've really enjoyed my time in the military. I don't think it's for everyone. I think people need to know what they're entering. But for me, I found it very personally rewarding and professionally rewarding as well. And I learned a lot. I'll give you a good example. In my office, I showed you a picture of me in Germany. When we were working for a brief period of time at the Landstuhl Medical Center. And on my first day there, the commander told me to go to a particular room and check on the wounded. So I went to the room, and I thought he gave me the wrong room number because there were just people sitting in chairs, like in a waiting room setting. So I came back, I said, which room did you say? And he said, and it was actually that room. And I said, I don't see any wounded, there's just people sitting there. He said, those are the walking wounded. Those are the people who have such bad PTSD, we're sending them back to the United States. Oh my God, I didn't realize. In my mind, wounded was wounded. And so that was powerful and memorable to know that, you know, we don't talk about the walking wounded, the ones who were impacted emotionally. And so that was just a learning experience that was very memorable and powerful. But I think the other piece was just, you know, they do a very good job, at least in the Air Force, in officer training school, in teaching us sort of how to give a presentation, how to give a briefing. So, you know, one of the reasons I thought I was a good and effective medical educator when I was teaching at NYIT Comm was I had learned in the Air Force about how to give a PowerPoint presentation, which I had never done before until my Air Force experience. I learned how to get images from the internet and add them, you know, basic things that I take for granted today. But then the other piece of advice was from a flight surgeon, senior flight surgeon, Colonel Hadley Reed, who taught us adapt, innovate, and overcome. Those are words I now live by, because while there's certainly opportunities to fix things if you notice a problem, sometimes you can't. And what do you do when you're up against something that's almost insurmountable? Adapt, innovate, and overcome. You have to move forward. You have to figure out a way to address the situation, which looking back, I thought was very osteopathic, if you think about it, right? Mm-hmm. We don't just look at the chief complaint. We look at the whole picture and try to figure things out. And so so my military background was and time was very good and useful. I developed a lot of lifelong friends, camaraderie. You learn about the value of teamwork. You know, we didn't care if we were an MD or DO. You couldn't tell, actually, from our uniform. My commanding officer was a nurse. So here was a doctor reporting to a nurse. You don't see that in the civilian world too often, but in the military, that's routine, depending on the rank. So a lot of learning was done, and I'm grateful for that.
Sounds like an incredible experience. I really like the adapt, innovate,
and overcome
perspective. It's something I challenged my faculty with, and we have to continue to adapt. Yeah. And it's hard. It certainly has challenges, and I think for medical students today, it's key because we know the landscape's changing fairly rapidly, and if we can't adapt, it's going to be even harder.
And you've been a big champion of that, so thank you, Nicole.
Absolutely. I am thankful for my training, and being an emergency physician has been key for me to be adaptable.
Absolutely.
So sounds like your military career was very, very instrumental and has been very heavily influenced on your career.
No regrets.
That's great. As you think about that, is there any other time in your career that really stands out as a period of growth or learning for you?
I think it would have to be that 2.5 year period between 2007 and 2009 when I was health commissioner on Long Island. I had never before taken on such a big responsibility. I'd just gotten my master's at the Harvard School of Public Health, and so I was academically ready for it, but to actually be in charge of a department that covers 1.5 million people, that has a budget of $400 million and something like 1,500 employees was quite a challenge. But I was comforted to know that, you know, when you're in these leadership roles, it's not just you. You know, you want to have the right sort of senior executive, senior staff, and mid-level staff to guide you, because you can't possibly know everything. And of course, in the middle of my tenure as health commissioner is when the last pandemic hit, the swine flu pandemic, as they called it, H1N1, and suddenly I was facing a barrage of TV cameras and radio and interviews, 1010 Winds and ABC News, and because there was a thought that maybe Long Island would be the epicenter for the H1N1. And just having that kind of experience, developing a comfort level with public speaking, and being thoughtful about the words I use, as I usually am with one-on-one with patients, but now recognizing that when there's a camera running, there are many more people reading into what you're saying and learning how to be thoughtful in public speaking and developing the right sort of balance between apathy and alarm. Because you want to be scared, but you don't want to be complacent. You want to be somewhere in the middle. And that's not easy to do, but that was a wonderful learning experience.
Yeah, that sounds really, really tough. Yeah. So I'm gonna switch gears again a little bit into medicine today and the future. So the last two decades certainly have been a time of rapid advancement in technology and medical care.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, how's this impacted the medical profession at large? And what are some things that are really positive about that? And where are some challenges?
So that's a great question. I think we're poised for, especially with artificial intelligence and generative AI, I think we're poised to use technology in ways that could not be imaginable before, in positive ways, to improve healthcare, to improve our understanding of what's happening, to improve our differential diagnosis. But at the same time, I think we also have to not forget the role of the human being, the role of the passionate doctor. I think all kinds of technologies are there to assist as an adjunct, but at the end of the day, I believe you still need to have a human role, a role for the human physician, the human clinician. And I think striking that right balance will be critical. I think medical students today, as you well know, are digital natives. This is not new to them. They're ready to take on new challenges and new technologies. But I think the challenge will be, when do you delegate to technology, right? You don't want to get too reassured by what technology offers, because there has to be a system of checks and balances. And yet the technology is so powerful that how can you not trust technology? So I think that's going to be an interesting struggle in the months and years ahead as ChatGPT and OpenAI and all these kinds of platforms move forward. So technology can be helpful. It has to be harnessed, it has to be utilized, and it has to be, and it has to have input from physicians before it becomes prime time. So I think that's the future.
Thank you for that. So to sort of expand on that a little bit, what are some of the personal qualities of a physician, well, that will help make an effective physician?
Oh, okay. Well,
today and the future.
This is where I think our osteopathic training really plays a role in, and I think we as a profession do a good job of it. We don't do a good job always of explaining it, but I think the holistic approach in everything that and what that implies. And so looking at every single issue as a complex set of issues and understanding every variable. That's starting to happen now in traditional medicine as well, as we begin to look beyond why is this patient here, but looking at things like social determinants of health and where are they living? What kind of home environment do they have? Those were types of questions that you and I, when we were in practice, didn't always ask or know what to do, even if we asked the question. So I think we're entering a time where we will have access to information about the patients that we see that we didn't always have. And I think it's important to be compassionate, to be empathic. And, you know, in our day, that was almost impossible if you didn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. You know, I did my internship in the South Bronx. I had to learn medical Spanish because without it, I couldn't be an effective doctor. But how can you do that if the world is increasingly diverse? I mean, how am I expected to take care of a patient who speaks Croatian? You know, unless I happen to be Croatian. But with technology, there may be a means to have that kind of conversation without relying on a child or a translator who may or may not be doing a good job of translating. So I think technology will enable us to do more, but we need to have the compassion in the first place to know when to apply that technology and when it's necessary and when it's not. So I think some of the basic skills that a physician brings to the table of caring, of being honest with themselves and others, and you know, reaching out to the patient, putting their hand on their wrist or their elbow makes a difference. Maintaining eye contact, all the things that we've been teaching doctors for decades still apply, even if there's technology. Now, technology has also been a barrier, as you know, because that, you know, in the last several years that I've gone to my doctor, there's like a laptop in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. Where the doctor's sort of doing this as he's typing in my answers to his questions, but maybe with AI, we can get rid of that laptop in the room and the patient can just have a conversation with their doctor the way we used to do. And then technology somewhere is recording that conversation, and not only recording it, putting it into a simple, succinct H&P form so that you don't actually have to do the typing. But where does the doctor come in? They have to review it and make sure it jibes with what they want that note to represent. I think that's going to make us able to take care of patients better. But I think we have larger system-wide issues, as you know, Nicole. We have health insurance issues. While the Affordable Care Act has helped millions of people get insurance, there are still people who are uninsured. We do a good job of emergency care, acute care, as you well know in your specialty, but we don't always do a good job with maternal mortality and infant mortality and all, some of the other indices that other countries seem to do better.
Yep. Well, I think we have some job security.
Yeah.
Another area in this vein, I think that's really important, and I know it's important to you as well, is professionalism in the medical field. So what, in your opinion, what are some of the primary issues as it relates to professionalism in medicine?
So I remember years ago, it was in New York actually, going to a talk, and I think the title was Medical Professionalism, I Know It When I Don't See It. Right? Because, which I thought was very clever, because how do you define professionalism, right? We all know when it's not there, right? It's pretty apparent, and we sort of know what to do about it, but how do you encourage people to be professional? Some would argue this begins in kindergarten. Others would argue it actually begins at the dining room table with your family. And so having the right role models, having the right way of understanding the world, contextually, is, I think, critical. And I don't know if people are having those kinds of family meals anymore. If they are, I hope the iPhone isn't a part of it, you know, because you would hope that people are just putting down their electronics and just engaging in conversation, because I think a lot of sort of what's right and what's wrong is supposed to be, you know, something you learn at the dinner table and also in school way before you decide to enter medicine. But when you do decide to enter medicine, I think that's where, you know, the worries about the hidden curricula come into play. We do the best we can, as you know, in school to teach students about what's right and what's wrong. But then as soon as they get into the hospital setting, it's eliminated like that when they realize, oh, nobody does that, and that they cut corners. And that's a shame. And so we need to figure that out. I don't know how best to do it. I think there are some doctors out there who maybe are tired and are frustrated, and that's fine. But they need to figure out a way to channel that frustration or address it without turning off the next generation of physicians. But I think that's an area that I know your school is trying very hard to inculcate. I think many schools are. I think WAMC and ACOM are doing what they can to nourish and encourage that kind of approach. And it's always been there, but I think there are some dangers. Social media has allowed people to sort of say things online that they would never in a million years say in person. And I think doctors are susceptible to that as well because they use technology too.
Mm-hmm. So still staying in the medical education vein, numerous programs and parameters and requirements related to medical education have remained unchanged for decades.
Yes.
And there's increased requirements, academic responsibilities, and lots of changes faced by medical students today, a lot of external environment influence. So what is your view on offering, you know, more flexibility in the time requirements and the educational programming for completing medical school?
That's a great question. I remember when, I think for a while, for at least 2 years, I was chair of the curriculum committee at NYITCOM. And it seemed like a zero-sum situation where if I wanted to add some content, they said, you know, you got to take something out. Mm-hmm. Like, why? I mean, like, well, you can't just keep adding. We're going to have to add a fifth year. I said, well, I'm not advocating a fifth year. But people were unwilling to let go sort of the curricula that they had. So I think faculty, since I'm no longer an assistant dean, I can say this, need to be open-minded about what truly, whether it's basic sciences or clinical sciences, what truly do your students need to know to be the best physicians they can be? That's not an easy conversation. It opens up issues of job security and whatnot and pride and ego. But I think those conversations are critical. I believe in watching from my perch at the FSMB that medical education is evolving towards this individual-centered approach. Some individuals, you know, we've seen these, are so intelligent, smart, able to pick up things so quickly, you know they can do medical school in 3 years. And there are others who maybe need a little more time for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe they need 5 years, maybe they need six. And yet we all force everyone to go through a four-year curriculum. So I think the state licensing boards have, in many states, eased up some of those requirements, because many of those states used to say it must be 4 years of medical school. Well, what if it's three? Is that necessarily a bad thing? So I think a lot of the state licensing boards are demonstrating flexibility. Schools are demonstrating flexibility. Some schools, as you know, don't even require the MCAT anymore because they want a holistic approach to interviewing. But I think being adaptable and flexible, not easy, right? Especially when you're dean and you have to create some sort of structure, I think is the challenge that we need to look at.
So we'll turn back to AI
sure.
a little bit. So many of your recent publications addressed artificial intelligence. Can you tell me more about your views about the emergence of AI and how you perceive it will affect healthcare and medicine moving forward?
So timely question, because the FSMB just last week held an AI symposium here in the nation's capital. We invited people from industry, attorneys, doctors, from our licensing boards, folks from our medical partner organizations. You know, ACOM was there, NBOME was there, but so were folks from the American Medical Association, American Telemedicine Association, and some legislative staff of various congressmen and senators. And it wasn't the first time, by the way, we had an AI symposium. The first time we did that was 2018. Mm-hmm. So we've been sort of tracking what's happening, but only now we think, especially with the advance of generative AI, which tries to mimic being a human, we are now, through our Ethics and Professionalism Committee, beginning to put together some recommendations for guardrails. Mm-hmm. Because while we share the excitement that AI is going to make a difference and make our lives better, and arguably it started to do that already, but we need to do that carefully, because there's a real risk and danger. What kind of risks and dangers are out there? One is through hallucinations, the technical term for when AI tries to be so helpful, it actually makes things up. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I don't think every doctor knows about that. So our ethics committee is in the process of drafting some recommendations. They'll go to our House of Delegates. Our annual meeting is in April in Nashville, Tennessee this year. And hopefully we'll get that adopted. But we're going to have to keep looking at this issue, because I think there are some real concerns about privacy, about data, about how information is used and by whom, and whether we are over-reliant upon technology. And also, from the context of licensure, what happens if something goes wrong? Mm-hmm. What if someone is harmed? What if someone dies? Yeah. Where is the recourse? Do you blame it on the machine? Yeah, I mean, normally you don't, but what if the machine, through deep learning, is acquiring new skills on its own? Can you say, well, I didn't tell it to do that, it sort of did it on its own? Is that the right way to address it? I think we're looking at that.
I'm glad you are. Yeah. That will be incredibly
no easy answers.
Helpful, right?
Yeah.
So as a medical educator, physician, can you offer any specific insights for medical students as they prepare to be the doctors of tomorrow?
For medical students?
Yeah, for medical students.
So it's going to sound corny. Mm-hmm. Pay attention. Listen. Not only to your fellow students and professors and staff, but also the people, the patients you'll be interacting with. How it is in the very beginning, as you're doing your first H&P, you know, you're sort of, as the patient is talking, you have a million things going through your mind and you wonder, how am I gonna keep all this together? But through practice, it does get better. It's graded in a way that this has been around for decades, so you are entering a profession that has thought through how you should be the best doctor that you can be. It's okay to be anxious. It's okay to be fearful. It's okay to ask questions. And it's okay to say, I'm sorry, I don't understand what's happening. And I want to understand, because I don't want to harm anyone. I want to be the best doctor that I can be. So be honest to yourself. Be honest to your colleagues and others. Learn. But also try to balance your life. Find opportunities to enjoy life and go to a movie, go out, go to a restaurant, hang out with your friends, and develop that, and take this opportunity to develop friendships. These will be lifelong friendships. I'm still friends with some of my classmates from the class of 1991 at NYITCOM, and I value those relationships. I know I can pick up the phone and contact them, and they'll always be there for me. Much like my Air Force colleagues, much like my colleagues at the Suffolk County Department of Health, and every place that I've worked. So it's an exciting field. Congratulations. You'll have a wonderful time ahead as you proceed through the routine.
That's great. Dr. Chowdhury, it has been a great honor to meet and talk with you today. Thank you for sharing your insights, experiences, and providing some really excellent advice.
Thank you. And thank you for your leadership of NYITCOM. I think you've done a phenomenal job. And I'm not just saying this because the cameras are on. Students tell me this, and faculty and staff tell me that as well. It's not easy being a dean. And you've done a stellar job. And I should say you're also a role model for other deans across the country.
Thank you for your very kind words. I'm grateful, and NYITCOM is grateful for our relationship. And thank you for all you do. I look forward to our future conversations and what will happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.